Welcome to the Agile Book Club. You're your hosts, Justyna and Paul.
Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Justyna. Oh, my.
So, Paul, what is the book about?
Today we're talking about a book by Debbie Madden entitled Hire Women, an Agile Framework for Hiring and Retaining Women in Technology. But I think we should kick it off the same way that we always do, with the elevator pitch. So you read this book as well, Justyna. Who would you pitch it to, and how would you pitch it?
Actually, I would pitch it to everyone who is a part of any company, of any group of people, because I think like this book addresses so many issues, that culture and work environment, it's so important for the success, that people are not just equal elements that you can exchange like in manufacture and they will work the same way. But if you want to build a company that strives for the best, you should care about the work environment more. And actually, by hiring and retaining women, it's not that you do something super, super special only for them. You build the place that it's better for everyone and that it's, at the end, better for your business as well. So it's not about charity. It's about having business wisdom, I would say. And you, Paul?
Mine is similar. It's going to be similar. Now, folks, to be fair, this is something that Justyna and I have spent many, many hours talking about. And so we've drifted towards a lot of similar opinions. So it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out in the podcast episode. But my suspicion is we're just going to be agreeing with each other a whole lot for the next hour.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah. So I also agree this is a book that should be widely read. It's not a book for managers. It's not a book just for the tech industry, even though it is about women in technology. I think that it's applicable to specifically any area of knowledge work, especially in places where women are underrepresented, because that is something of a litmus test. If I see an environment in which women are underrepresented, that probably speaks to the quality of the culture of the environment. And so I would say it's anyone can read this book, and really, especially considering that the book is easy to read, short and cheap, there's really no reason not to read the book if you care about creating a healthy work culture, saving money. She talks a lot about that and why it's important. I want to get into that in the takeaways. Growing the organization, having happier coworkers or employees, or heaven forbid, if you want to destroy the patriarchy. So it's short, easy, cheap, lots of ideas, easy to implement. And what I really liked about it is it was written by an executive, but it was written to everyone. So there's advice about how you can implement these ideas in your organization if you're doing it from a position of power, but also if you're not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, at each level. Yeah, that's true. So what would be your first takeaway?
Okay, she launches this book. I think just to give a little bit of context, the book starts out with an argument for why it is important to attract and retain women if you run a technology business. And then it goes into the basic thing, elements that you have to have in place before you can do that. And then it talks about specific practices that you can use for hiring and retaining women, which is right there in the title. So I think it might be easiest to go in that same structure. The first thing that she launches with is the extraordinary expense of staff turnover. Mm-hmm. She cites a number of reports that have all come to different conclusions. Anywhere between 90 and 200% of the annual salary of an employee is the cost of replacing an employee. And that's a huge range, obviously, but you'd expect that. It probably varies by role and varies by position, varies by industry and such. But it's still enough that whether it costs 90% of a person's salary to replace them when they quit, or 200% or anywhere in between, that's an enormous cost for a business, and especially a tech business whose largest cost is payroll. So right there, if there's anything that you can do in order to reduce employee turnover, that's probably going to be the biggest impact on the bottom line that you can have, especially if there's any low-hanging fruit. And she points to quite a bit of low-hanging fruit in this book.
But actually, This is something that I really cannot understand. And maybe, Paul, you can help me to understand that. Because I've seen that not only in the tech industry, in a lot of finance corporations that are in Kraków that my friends are working, they have the same problem that they are not getting promoted or not valued. Like they are sometimes treated, you know, in not the human way, like just like those elements in this being machine. And for me, it's such a short-term perspective because then they change the job, as you described. The costs are so high. And I'm just all the time asking myself, why people don't see that this is expensive, that if they would give them the opportunity for growth, that they want to grow, they work hard, they try their best, but they just don't have this work environment that cherish that. If they would just give it to them, it will be easier and better for everyone. And I really, really don't understand why. Can you tell me why, Paul, please?
Well, you know, I have suspicions. I have suspicions because I've worked in two very, very different environments. I have worked in small startups that I've started myself. I worked in an IT company, which I started and ran myself. And so from that perspective, I see those costs. Even if it's not money, just the effort involved when you're running an IT company and you have to interview everyone yourself,
yeah.
It's really painful to replace someone. But I've also worked in middle management in large corporations, and I think there's something kind of built into the system which is flawed, and that is that many people who work in large corporations only know that world, and it makes sense that that would be so. If it's surprising how many people who are recruited by the corporate world straight out of university and spend their entire careers, maybe not at the same company, but hopping from large corporation to large corporation.
Yeah.
And so they never actually get in that position in which they are responsible, in which they have profit and loss responsibility for example, a development team like I did. And so they don't question the turnover. There's always new people coming in. There's always people coming out. It doesn't cost them personally because they have team leads and such who handle the interviewing process. So it doesn't take a great deal of time out of a middle manager's schedule to replace a designer here and a developer there and a tester there. And they accept it as natural because it's always happening anyway. And most of the work is done by human resources, which is a completely different department mm-hmm. altogether. So when you need somebody, there's always a list of CVs and you pass them out and your little hiring people do their little hiring thing. And unless there's some significant change in turnover, you don't really notice it. It's business as usual.
But don't you think that people who work in this organization, their level of motivation is low or lower because of that?
I'm not going to say that because okay. I have been in organizations that have handled culture very well.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I started, my first big corporate job was not in IT. It was after I finished university with a degree in anthropology. And you know what you can do with a degree in anthropology, right? But once you've used it for that and flushed it, you then have to get a job. And and I got lucky. I got a job with a huge corporation called Aramark. And it was in one of the most unpleasant environments imaginable because Aramark does all sorts of business-to-business services, uniform cleaning and food for hospitals and for airplanes, but they also do food for prisons. And so my job actually required me to go to prison every day. And you can imagine, I'm locked into a building surrounded by people who really, 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 really don't want to be there.
Mm.
There's as for unpleasant work environments, you can't do a whole lot worse than that, except perhaps a meat processing plant. And yet, the corporation of Aramark had a really, really healthy culture. I didn't get to interact with there was no natural reason why I should interact with my mm-hmm. colleagues in other prisons and such, and yet they created lots of opportunities to have a kind of a sense of camaraderie, to be able to share ideas and such with other people who are your peers. they were very good at promoting good people. One of the things that happens in corporations is that senior leaders tend to, or even middle managers, tend to have their favorites and keep them close. And Aramark did a wonderful thing there. They would recognize people's promotions, but they would also recognize the managers who identified and mentored them. So every single time someone got a promotion, they'd get a pat on the back and recognition for the manager who identified that talent. And so I had people who would have liked to keep me close because it was easy to have me around because I was really good at what they did, but they were also incentivized to help keep me going up the ladder on my career. So I know that corporations can be mind-numbing brain factories that just go through people like a meat grinder, but they don't have to be. They can also be very positive and enriching. So I wouldn't say that, but I know that you're talking about the ones that are the former, not the latter. And and yes, that does happen. Although what you do find is, and again, like I said earlier, there's a lot of people who just get into that corporate environment and stay in it their whole lives. And people who do that often have high levels of intrinsic motivation. I've worked in environments in which the environment wasn't particularly nurturing, but people had a great deal of drive, whether it's because they're really, really passionate about craftsmanship or they're really passionate about just, they get a lot of satisfaction from being the best and getting a lot done, or they get a lot of satisfaction from helping others. Mm-hmm. And so it's a different place, and sometimes it can be soul-crushing, but it doesn't necessarily have to be.
Yeah, I didn't want to offend, like, you know, corporate work environment, but that was just one of the observation that I had. And actually, when Debbie was describing in the book that you can build the work environment that cherish and help everyone to grow, I thought, like, yes, I hope more people would actually see that. And it's connected with one of my takeaways, which was to allow the promotion at any time. To don't have these times periods during the year that, okay, now is the season for promotions. We're just going to promote 5 people because that's the number of spots. But that just actually give people opportunity to become better and to see their achievements when they accomplish them. I think, like, that's more natural way of saying that was a good job. You achieved this and we are happy with you and we are proud of you and you get promotion. Mm-hmm. Rather than waiting and waiting, yeah.
Or we know that you're a better programmer than him, but he's been here 10 years and you've only been here 1 year, so we can't make you senior to him.
Yeah. But actually, I liked what she mentioned in the book about the transparent compensation system, when they put it this amount of time for the developer that you have to be 2 years to get to the, I think, mid position, and that it actually brought the reverse result, that people get less motivated because mm-hmm. they were thinking, no matter how hard I try, it has to be like 2 years till I get promotion. So, yeah.
Yeah, that can be really discouraging when your efforts aren't recognized. Although, now that we're getting into this, I'm going to take issue with this because moving on to the next step in this book is the second chapter is all about how you shouldn't start trying to attract and retain women if you don't have a healthy culture.
Yes.
So before you start worrying about how are we going to hire more women, how are we going to retain the women that we have, you should focus on 2 things she enumerates. One is having fair salaries. Mm-hmm. And then the other is having a zero tolerance policy for harassment. And I have some issues with what her ideas about fair salaries. You can probably imagine.
Yes.
2 in particular, she says flat out, as though this is just a known thing, that you shouldn't have transparent salaries because people have a right to privacy and a salary is a very private thing. So flat out, not a thing that can happen, not a thing you should do. I own a software company that has transparent salaries, and it's not an easy thing to do, but it's amazing the amount of bureaucracy that is required to ensure that you have fairness in your salary system when you don't have transparent salaries is huge. She has to describe salary bands and how every single position has to have a very detailed description of what a person in that position has to be able to do. And if a person has that position and they match that job description, then they can earn only so much money and not less than so much money. But so we know vaguely how much they earn, but we don't know specifically how much they earn. All of this bureaucracy is completely unnecessary if you have transparent salaries, because then the system just becomes self-organizing.
Yeah, it was kind of tricky also for me when I read this chapter about all the requirements, and I was just wondering, how does it look like in the real life when you have this conversation? Because at some point you might just give away something that you shouldn't, just to explain better why you're at this stage right now, what you have to do to get there. And some of the things, I believe, they get outdated, so you have to make sure that you keep everything updated. So it sounded like a lot of work to do that. But I like what she mentioned, that you have to know why this person has this salary, and you have to know how to explain that to other people, just to look into their eyes and have the confidence of saying why. That this is actually, I think, a matter of respect that some of people very often don't have. They don't know how to talk about money, or they know that they made some bad decisions because, for example, they had to fill the position, they had to hire someone. So without knowing exactly the skills of that person, they just offer more than other people that are already in this organization earn. So there's a lot of policies in those conversations. So that's tricky.
Yes, absolutely. I think most organizations would be horrified if their salary tables were made public.
Yeah,
Because these things happen. Not only those sort of isolated incidents, but also general patterns. Like, I know I ran a software company for 10 years, and men ask for raises more than women do, in my experience. You have to be more proactive about keeping women's salaries on an even level with men's, because the women won't do it, in general. I mean, individual women will, but in general, men ask for salary increases more often, and men are more likely to negotiate a salary both on being hired, which has a huge impact. A 10% difference in salary at hiring can magnify itself over a decade-long career dramatically. Where you start has a huge impact on where you end up, but they also negotiate their salary increases. When I offer women a salary increase, they're more likely to just say thank you. And when I offer a man a salary increase, they're more likely to say, couldn't we go just a little bit higher than that? Mm-hmm. And those sorts of things, especially when, now in a large corporation, middle managers, again, they've got a budget that they're responsible for, but they've got a lot of flexibility and leeway in there. And most people don't like conflict. And as you say, people are very uncomfortable talking about money. So when somebody comes, when you offer somebody a salary increase and they ask for 2% more, it's easier to just say yes. But if it's only the men asking for that 2% more, and they ask for that 2% more in every salary increase, by the time they get into middle management, there's a huge gap, a 37% gap.
So what do you mean by being proactive in helping women to ask for a raise? How did you do it?
You have to just look at the numbers. You have to look at the numbers yourself. If you don't have transparent salaries, then it becomes management's responsibility to review all of those salaries periodically and to make sure that they are fair, and to go in and give people a raise that they didn't ask for, just because you have to, because it's due. And she says that. That was the other concern that I had with her idea of these salary bans, is that having salary bans might control things a bit, but to have any kind of a useful salary band, and even the numbers that she gives in the book, it has to be large enough that you can still have a fair amount of discrimination inside of a salary band. If you've got men at the top of the band and women at the bottom of the band, those bands haven't actually solved the problem. Management still needs to proactively review salaries across the board and make sure that they are not discriminating.
Which leads me to my another takeaway, which was about discovering and understanding your bias, that very often we don't see how many biases we have. And it was very interesting because I was reading this book when I was in Valencia, and I was actually thinking a lot how many bias do I have that I was not aware of? And then I was looking at my mom and thinking how many bias she has and that she was not aware of too. And I was trying to experiment with a clean language to talk with her, to actually help her to understand. So that was a fun weekend. But I liked a few ideas that she presented. And one of them was that when there is interview and there is the recruitment process for a developer, what we can do, and it's super simple, it's actually send a code to review without saying who is the author of that code, without giving away the gender of the person who wrote it. Mm-hmm. And I think that this is something very, very simple that each of the company they can do, like just like that, without any extra effort, just if they care enough for diversity and inclusion. So yeah, I will try to promote this idea in any company that I will talk to, because it's cheap. You don't have to do anything with that. And I think that's powerful. And they might be even shocked with the kind of results that they will get at the end of the process.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That's based on the famous symphony orchestra example, which she also cites in this book. And for those of you who haven't heard this, there used to be, I mean, still is in many symphonies, but it used to be very, very common that that male musicians dominated in symphonies. And I believe it was the Symphony in New York who did this first, because they identified this as a problem. And they started having all of their auditions behind a screen so that the people who were evaluating a musician's performance when they were auditioning to join the orchestra could not see the gender of the musician. And I recall from one of the early articles about this that there was still some bias, and it was because of high-heeled shoes.
Mm-hmm.
Women who wore high-heeled shoes were getting selected less often than women who wore flats. Because even if you couldn't see the performer, you had some kind of a mental image just based on the sound of them walking on stage. So they put carpet on the stage, and all of a sudden, women started getting positions in the orchestra.
Yeah.
And there's another example, which I think is something that you can actually use in your business as well to explore these biases. She cited one study that I wasn't familiar with, and I'm going to check my notes so I can quote it correctly. Okay, here it is. It was a case study at Columbia Business School. The professor was named Frank Flynn, and he gave his whole class a case study about a successful venture capitalist. But what the class didn't know is that half of the class both case studies were exactly the same, but for half the class, the name of this venture capitalist was Howard, and for the other half, it was Heidi. Otherwise, all the details were the same. And after reading the case study, one of the things that the students had to do was to take a poll to indicate how much they liked this venture capitalist. And regardless of the gender of the students, both male and female students tended to like Howard and dislike Heidi, even though they had read the exact same case studies mm-hmm. about each of them. And the author makes an observation, which I'll quote exactly because I liked it. Nobody knows why this is. Perhaps it's because we unconsciously associate women with the home and men with a career. And when a woman challenges this unconscious bias, we react with anger.
Mm-hmm. And when I read this part of the book, I recalled one of the conversations that we had when you told me that when women raise her voice and start screaming because she's angry, she's a drama queen. Yes, she's like, you know, getting her issues and she should be quiet. But when man is actually screaming, it's like he's so powerful.
And people, passionate, yeah.
Yes, passionate and powerful. And that was exactly the thought that I had in my mind when I read this chapter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mary Beard does a fabulous job of exploring that concept in her book, Women in Power. And taking it a bit further, which is that we have these ideas of what power looks like. We have these ideas of what power sounds like. Power sounds like a deep voice. Power doesn't sound like a shrill voice, which is interesting, because it just occurred to me that supposedly Abraham Lincoln had a very high-pitched, squeaky, shrill voice that was unpleasant to listen to. And so he probably wouldn't have been elected if he had lived in the days of radio. But now that we have all of these images of power, and they're mm-hmm. mostly images of men in power, we've got these ideas about how tall power should be and how deep power should sound.
Mm-hmm.
And yes. when we see power that doesn't look or sound like that, we don't recognize it for what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And so we really need to fundamentally redefine our ideas of power before women can wield it effectively.
Yes, and discover our own bias. Mm-hmm. I think that's really goes along here.
And she has a tool for that. So one of my takeaways was the tool. I really liked the bias mind map idea because one of her ideas is to start with this idea of exploring biases and then look and create a mind map of all of the areas in which there might be biases. Are there biases in our recruitment process? Well, from that step in the recruitment process, the next step in the mind map might be, well, how about our hiring page? Are there biases there? How about our interview style? Are there biases there? How about the way in which we process CVs? Are there biases there? What have you? And so it's not what I liked about it, is the mind map approach is a way that people can expand all of the areas into which they might explore and look for biases in a collaborative and non-threatening way.
Mm-hmm.
So you can say, I think there might be some biases in our interview process. Let's talk about them without saying, I think that Joe might be a biased interviewer.
Oh, yes. Yeah, it's like a group discovery process. And yeah.
Right. So I thought that was very nice.
Mm-hmm. And I like generally all the ideas that she presented in the book about collaboration on diversity inclusion in companies, that it's not only HR work, that mm-hmm. it's not just a document that it's created like code of conduct and no one ever see that and no one talks about it. They maybe have seen it on the introduction week when they joined the company, but they never ever come back. She makes the code of conduct something that should be constantly updated in the company and that everyone has easy access. Everyone can question, everyone can have influence on how it should look like. And I think that this is, again, something that it's so cheap to do in the company. You don't have to actually hire 10 specialists to help you to do that. If you are in this position to actually start questioning the things, you have the impact on how your work environment looks like and you can collaborate to bring a better future for everyone.
Yes, and you've got to have those conversations in order to identify. 'Cause here's another just kind of broad general criticism that I had of this book, and that is that she approaches the topic as though everyone in an organization is either going to be in favor of increasing gender mm-hmm. diversity or neutral. And in my experience, that's not the case at all. In any given group of people that don't have a culture that embraces diversity, there are going to be people who are losers.
What do you mean?
I don't mean losers. I mean there will be people who will lose if you are successful. It's not a zero-sum game. And if you're in an organization, especially a mature organization that has never valued diversity, then it's very likely that the people in power in that organization got there precisely because of qualities which would not serve them well in an organization that had a healthy culture that valued diversity. You've got a lot of people who are in power because they are tall and commanding and domineering mm-hmm. and...
So and it's that threatening, can, yeah? That's it, what
it
you
is,
mean.
Not only is it threatening, but there's also people who have strongly held ideas which are not subtle biases, but actual beliefs. I usually try to come out early on in any kind of engagement so that people know where I stand, because something interesting happens when you start talking about diversity and inclusion outwardly and clearly, and when you identify yourself as a person who advocates for feminism in an organization, is two kinds of people gravitate to you. People who share those ideas and those ambitions and want to help and support you, and people who legitimately want to have a conversation about their disagreements. So I have had, for example, in a large corporation, men in management positions come to me because I'm organizing a code retreat for women, for example, and say, you know, Paul, I've always wondered why women should be paid the same amount as men when they take 1 year of maternity leave for every child they have. If they don't work as much as men, why should they be paid the same? Now, you can say that that's a horrible thought to have, but it's a worse thought to have and not voice than to actually explore, because I can have that conversation, but only with a person who feels safe talking to me about it. There are very prominent people in our industry who believe it's important to create an environment in which people can rise based solely upon their skill in that position, their skill at the job, and make a strong case for meritocracy. And they honestly, honestly believe it. And the end result of actually believing in meritocracy in your organization, combined with the reality of a very, very small number of women in those positions, is that one must believe, and I've heard people voice this belief, that there aren't more women here because women don't like it.
Yeah. I'm sorry that I'm laughing, but it's so terrifying that whenever I hear it, I just have two reactions. Should I cry or laugh? Because it's so, yeah.
That's a difficult and painful conversation to have, and I've lost friends over it. But these are actual objections. At the last big organization, like big mega corporation I was in, I had so many of these conversations. I ended up publishing a document internally that just itemized all of the criticisms of diversity and inclusion that I had come across in that organization, along with my responses. I've got a copy of it here, so. And these are ideas that people legitimately hold, and it's worth to bring out to have the conversation. Mm-hmm. So there's a lack of diversity, but it's not our fault. It's caused by a lack of diversity in the candidate pool. So there are people who will just say...
Shifting blame.
Well, it is. And there are people who will say that 13% of the graduates from the technical university were women, and... our technical teams here are 12% women, which is pretty close. So basically, it's just reflective of the greater world. Mm-hmm. It's not our fault, and there's nothing we can do about it. I have a response to that, as you can imagine. But another common one is meritocracy. So we value diversity, but we're committed to meritocracy. And so we'd like to hire and promote more women, but we haven't met ones who are... the best candidates. And that's a reasonable position to have. Now, I have responses to people who believe that too. The one that really gets to me is the reverse discrimination one. We value diversity, we'd like to hire and promote more women, but it wouldn't be fair to the men. And
how did you answer to the last one about the reverse discrimination?
Okay, there's a couple things. Number one, and I'm going to get myself into some trouble here, but I am opposed to the concept of meritocracy. I'll just say it. Now, the author actually makes a case for meritocracy, and she mentions meritocracy in the book, but I don't believe in meritocracy for two major reasons. Number one, meritocracy implies that there is some kind of objective measure, and there is no objective measure for what makes a good employee. There's just not. If it's based solely on skills, I guarantee you I can find a person who excels in those skills and will not perform, will hurt your business by just being there. It's simply because of a toxic personality. They can do the job as long as they're left alone by themselves and no one has to deal with them. That's not a person you should promote. There are also people who don't have a high level of skill, but their presence on a team changes the whole team dynamic. They get people working together better. They facilitate conversations. They bring an enormous amount of enthusiasm and creativity. And to say that this person should never be promoted because he doesn't have the requisite technical skills, I think is also a mistake. Mm-hmm. And so you can't actually create a true objective meritocratic system. Now, this is where the problem comes in. If you can't have a meritocracy, but you still believe that you can, then what you're actually doing is doing your hiring and promotion based on unconscious biases that you're not willing to explore. Mm-hmm. And doing it in the name of meritocracy. So one of the things that I often say is, you say you value diversity. How much? How much do you value it? If you have two candidates for a position, one of whom is only slightly more qualified than the other, but would not bring any diversity to the team, then how much do you value diversity? Do you value it enough that it would kick the other candidate up a notch? Mm-hmm. And if you don't, if you hire the person, if you hire the white man who is only slightly more experienced, not enough to make a difference. For so many of these positions, what I'm looking for in a technical position is adequate technical skills. You know, it's impossible through an interview process to be able to really effectively stack rank people, especially if you have an adequate number of candidates. And so there might be four or five or six candidates, all of whom who could do the job, you know. And once you've identified that somebody has a technical skill to do the job, basically to do the job, then you have to start looking at other factors. And I think personality is an important factor. Values is a very important factor. Their background, their perspectives are a very important factor. And these things are a lot fuzzier. They're mm-hmm. a lot harder to pin down. That makes people feel uncomfortable. But you can't value diversity and then not let diversity sway a decision, because then you don't really value it.
And what was the company response for this internal document that you published that you just read?
It was really interesting. There was no official response. But like I said, I find it to be very healthy, for me anyway, to mm-hmm. be very upfront with my ideas, because it attracts these people to me. So, for example, in this company, they had a diversity committee. Mm-hmm. This committee was inactive. They didn't really do much. They spoke at a couple of external events, but there wasn't a whole lot of things happening. And so people started gravitating to me and meeting each other in this way. And we started organizing different events to encourage diversity and inclusion. And ultimately, what ended up happening is that these groups of people started a different initiative. So if your diversity and inclusion committee isn't performing, mm-hmm. then employees can form their own women in tech community or what have you. But in a large organization, it's difficult for these people to meet unless they have some kind of a catalyst. Mm-hmm. And an outspoken feminist can be a very effective catalyst for bringing such people together.
But I never heard what you've done about this internal document, but I think that it's very powerful, because a lot of people inside companies, they are even not aware of how they act or what is, I don't want to say what is wrong, but maybe what is harmful for other people. And I had this example. I had a friend and I was doing interview with him, and he's one of the kindest men on earth. Really, he's so smart, so kind. He wouldn't hurt a fly, really. And then we had interview, and there was a woman that came there, and she was a little bit shy. And I always ask, like, what is your superpower? What is the skill that you could teach us? Because we are looking also for people who do something outside of the work. Like, I mean, we wanted to get to know them better. We didn't want to just focus on their hardcore skills, but just to get them know as people. And she got super shy. She didn't know what to say and she got confused. So I tried to give her some examples, like what other people inside the company do, just to give her a perspective of what she can say. But instead of helping her, I made her even more shy. And then he couldn't stay the awkwardness of this situation. And he made a joke that was terrible. He said, like, you know, like, super good ironing or delicious cooking. And, you know, I was like, what? In the moment, I just wanted, like, to kill him. But I just carried on with the conversation and we finished the interview. And once we finished, I told him, like, listen, are you aware of what you have done? I said, like, what have I done? I don't understand why you're angry at me. And I said, okay, I'm a little bit angry at you. There was a moment that I thought that I would just kick you under the table, but I thought that that wouldn't be too quiet, so I just stopped myself. But what you've just said was a terrible thing. Like, you just told woman who comes for the interview for the tech position that her superpower might be ironing or cooking. That was like really the worst thing that you could done. And then I explained it to him and we had the conversation, and he was shocked. He got super sad when he came home. I got a message from his wife and she's like, oh my God, I've heard what he've done and he's feeling so sorry. He was not aware of that. I hope that you are not angry at him and stuff. And I said, no, I'm not angry at him, but I just had to explain to him that when he was trying to help, he actually uses a stereotype and make her maybe even feel less viable for the company. And that's, yeah, but he was not a bad person. That's why I really like what you have done, that you just put outside your thoughts to just share with people like what is happening, that they might be like more aware of how they behave.
And this is one of my other takeaways, is that she describes this as an iterative process, because it is an agile approach to hiring and retaining women. So it is an iterative approach, and an organization must constantly be learning how to do it better. Now, your example, I think, is a really interesting one, because one of the things I like to remind myself of is that I guarantee you, if I listen to this podcast in 5 years or 10 years, some of the words that are coming out of my mouth right now will horrify me.
Oh, yes.
You know?
I have the same feeling.
And so when you characterize people who have a wrong thought as bad people, then good people are people who have no wrong thoughts.
Yeah.
And that kind of makes us all bad people. President Barack Obama made a similar statement when he was being critical of political correctness in a speech just last week. He said, you have to understand these things are fuzzy, and there's a lot of gray areas, and we all have, and he didn't say this, but he's done this himself. I mean, President Barack Obama himself, when he first ran for office, was against gay marriage, outly, vocally against gay marriage. And when he advocated for it during his second term, people said, but you were against it. And he said, my feelings and my opinions evolved. And that's what that's what happens. And so if you categorize people as good people and bad people based on whether or not their ideas are woke, as woke as they can possibly be, then you're not going to be able to grow and change as an organization. You have to keep exploring these things, and at the same time do so with empathy. The only bad person is the person who is actively negatively opposed to the direction in which the organization has to go in order to be healthy. And so I think it's a mistake to think that starting some kind of a diversity and inclusion program inside of an organization is going to have only positive benefits. There are going to be people who can't exist in that sort of environment because they got to where they got to be in the environment that they're in right now. And so there's going to be initial turnover, there's going to be growing pains, but there's a lot of people who are very, very willing to continue to learn as long as you do it, as long as you can have the conversation. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, this manager who didn't believe that women should be paid the same amount of money. We could have a conversation, and that was a conversation that actually spanned about 6 months, and it came up again and again in different contexts. And now he thinks about women differently. He's not a bad person.
Yeah. you are right, because I think also the society that we are in, that we grow, what we've seen, it influences us. And as you said, we just have to grow, talk, learn. Yeah. Any other takeaways, Paul?
Yeah. Okay, here's one that I liked a lot. It is that it's the idea of having anti-goals, which I thought was kind of an interesting idea. She was talking about just working on a few goals at a time. So once you've done your bias mind map and you've identified all of the various changes that you could make to your interviewing process, your hiring process, your job ads, the way in which you, all of the various things, don't try to tackle them all at once. Prioritize them and work on just a few things at a time. But for each one of these things, have some sort of a goal. Like, we want to increase the number of women that we hire by 5%, or we want to reduce the turnover of female employees by 10% by the end of this year. But also, you can have an anti-goal, and we want to do that without increasing male turnover.
Mm-hmm.
Which kind of jumps out at me, because initially I think you probably would. If like I've said already, yes, on this podcast, when you start tinkering with the culture, there are going to be people who aren't going to be comfortable with that, and they will leave.
Mm-hmm.
And these are people you shouldn't have hired in the first place, but but sometimes an organization outgrows a person, and mm-hmm. sometimes a person outgrows an organization. And mm-hmm. if your organization is outgrowing some of your staff members, yes, then you need to let them go.
Yeah, it's a natural process, this friction, I think. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I look at mine, but I think that I'm good with all my takeaways. Some of them you covered, so I don't want to repeat what you've just said.
So there were a few things. Now that we're talking more in general terms, the book as a whole, it's a very small book, and I wish it were bigger. So, for example, she mentions that the reasons for hiring and retaining women are... What I recall from that chapter is it reduces turnover costs, because turnover is very expensive, and it creates an environment in which people can communicate better with each other. Because she makes the point that if the person sitting across from you looks just like you, you make assumptions that mm-hmm. they think just like you, and so you don't ask so many questions, you don't explore as much. And when the person sitting across from you looks different than you, you don't assume that they think like you do. But there's so many other things she could have said. She didn't talk about the value of having teams working on products and services who can more easily empathize with the users of those products and services. So for many of these software products, half of the users are women. And so if the products are built by men, that's not to say that a man can't understand how a woman uses a piece of software, for example, or a product. But it's harder. They have to do more work.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you've got people inside of the company that are more representative of the people outside of the company who are consuming those services, it's going to be easier to design services that work for your users. Or she didn't mention anything about collective intelligence. So what was her name? Dr. Anita Woolsey's research? On collective intelligence, in which she was trying to identify why some groups of people are better at problem solving than others, and pin down this, what she called this mysterious factor C, this thing that allowed some people, some groups of people, to make better decisions. And the correlation was the number of women. And mm-hmm. and the suggestion is that it has to do with empathy. And I always resist the idea that women have more empathy than men. But I think that if empathy is a bell curve, and you had a bell curve for empathy in a large representative sample of women and men, there'd be a lot of overlap, but the women's group would be right-shifted.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm just laughing because once I've heard that if you show something on the graph, it's smart, it's a fact, and everyone would believe it. So if you use the term curve, it sounds like a scientific fact, and all our listeners will make sure it's good.
Well, if you don't know anything about a person's empathy level, and if you have no way of measuring a person's mm-hmm. empathy level, and you have to choose between a man and a woman, and you're hiring for empathy, your better bet's going to be, if this was Vegas, bet on the woman. And the other interesting thing that came out of Dr. Woolsey's research was that one woman doesn't cut it. I was once asked to speak about empathy at a large tech organization during one of their public meetings. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that the president said during the introductory statements is how they were really proud of the work in recruiting women into their technology teams. Now, every single one of their tech teams has a woman in it. And that was literally true. They wanted to make sure that there was a woman in every team. So every time they would hire a woman, they'd put her into a team that had no women in it until every team had a woman. Yeah.
I see it right now, one of the organizations that I know. Seriously, yes.
And this is a huge organization, and so they had to hire quite a few women to get one woman into every single tech team. But that means that every single woman in their entire technology department, when they go to a meeting, they're the only woman in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that came out of Dr. Woolsey's research is that I say her name twice every time because I'm unsure of it. Woolley or Woolsey?
I thought Woolsey, but I'm not sure.
No, it's Woolley. W-O-L-L-E-Y. Dr. Woolley's research was that, and she did, but basically what she did is she had groups of people trying to solve problems together, and then she looked at how well they solved the problems and looked at what the differences were between the groups of people, and the most easily identifiable difference was the gender mix. And what she found is that having one woman on a team of men has no impact whatsoever on that team's ability to solve complex problems. Mm-hmm. You need more than one woman. But also, she found that a team of all women does not outperform a team that has diversity between mm-hmm. women and men. So a group of women together doesn't optimize collective intelligence, but one woman doesn't make a difference. Mostly because I think of all of those biases, those cultural biases that we have that keep women from being heard when they're alone in a room with a bunch of men and there's nobody in there who's actively working to magnify her voice.
Yes, and one of the observations that I had actually from this company that I mentioned before, my friend, she's working there and she's a woman and yeah. She's male. And the thing is, she told me, I hate being the only one woman in the team. Because I see the difference when I'm there and when I'm not there, how they communicate, the conversation that they have. I hear that jokes stop when I enter the room, and I hate that. I cannot share more with them because I'm not one of them.
Oh goodness!
That's how she feels. Or for example, she's delegate to talk with other teams because she's a woman. She has better communication skills. So.
Or they ask her to take notes.
Yes. Because she has better handwriting because she's a woman, yeah. But the thing is, like, they wanted to have more diversity, inclusion, and it was their goal, as you described. It was a similar state. They made it as a statement that they will increase number of women in tech. And then they started, like, a puzzle to put one woman at the team without even looking what kind of personality she has and what is mm-hmm. the group dynamics. It was just, we put woman here, problem fixed, done, next team, please.
Yeah, it's an awful place to be. It's an awful position to be in. I think I had a talk with this CEO afterwards, and I don't know whether he did it. If he did, it would be in the news because this was a very big and very public organization. Mm-hmm. But it would be really interesting to see if they shuffled up their teams and had half of the teams all men and half of the teams more diverse. But when you were talking, it reminded me of another conversation because it's really interesting. And I think it helps probably to some extent to be a middle-aged man who's taking this position inside of an organization because most of the people in power are also middle-aged men. So these managers who are coming to me with their good intentions, but their legitimate concerns, felt like they could talk to me mm-hmm. and say horrible things to me. Another one said, and he thought he was a proponent of gender diversity in tech, but his reason was that having women around make the men behave better, which is another conversation that has to be had, you know?
Yes. I've heard thousands of those. But maybe I will jump to my favorite quotation because it goes... it goes nicely with the current conversation that we have. So, diversity doesn't start with hiring. It ends with hiring. Before you can hire more people onto your team, you first have to create a safe and equal working environment for everyone who already exists on your team.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That was the essence of the book for me.
Yes. Yes, indeed. And that everyone on the team, I think, is really important. You made the point at the very beginning, which Naomi Cedern made on our stage at ACE a few years ago, which is that there's a lot of areas in which our industry could benefit from diversity. Women in tech is a low-hanging fruit because they are the only underrepresented group who is not actually a minority. There are a ton of them. But also that everything that you do to improve a work environment for women improves a work environment for everyone. And when I was listing the reasons why people might actually want to increase diversity, not the ones that are not good reasons for doing it, but the legitimate reasons for it, one of them is that most men are not belligerent, arrogant, egotistical, power-hungry, boisterous, drunken thugs. We're all taught how to be that way. Mm-hmm. By society, by school, by television, by violent movies. We know how to act the act, but most men aren't. And a fairly large number of us are introverts and don't feel comfortable playing the role that society would cast mm-hmm. us in. And I can tell you, when you're in a prison, working in a prison, surrounded by big men, the pressure to play that role is incredibly high. And when you leave that industry to go into IT and you find yourself surrounded by the same kind of environment, and it's a very difficult role to play if it doesn't come naturally to you. And so I really feel uncomfortable when I'm in an organization that's all men, because mm-hmm. I don't feel like I can be myself. And when I work in companies that have a good gender balance, it's also a litmus test. It is a really clear indicator to me that it's okay for me to bring my authentic self to work. And I cannot be the only man who thinks that way.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any favorite quotations?
I did. So this one I'm going to quote directly from the opening paragraph, because I really liked it. Like all companies, Stack Overflow has an infinite list of things to do, but limited resources. In recent years, diversity and inclusion efforts have consistently been fairly important, like number 3 on our list of priorities, which meant they got allocated roughly 0 resources, admits the EVP, Executive Vice President of Culture and Experience at Stack Overflow. So indeed, if diversity and inclusion is high on your list of priorities, you know, number 3, there's a good chance it's not getting any funding or investment of time or energy. So I like that, because we all know it's important, but aren't profits more important? We all know it's important, but isn't maintaining our market position more important? If you don't see the clear connection between creating a healthy work environment and all of the other goals of your company, then you'll never get around to doing it. Do you have another one? You know what I mean? Okay. I've got a bunch of favorite quotes, but I'm not going to go through all of them. But there is one other that I'd really like to share. And I like this a lot. If you put all of your effort into hiring women into entry-level and mid-level roles, it's going to take you a really long time to get there. And in this mm-hmm. case, there is a healthy work environment that has gender diversity at all levels. And you might not get there at all, because all of those women may never see people above them. And they may opt to get out before they get there themselves. And this is one of the challenges that I see a lot that we're working with. It's the reason why you and I started up the Women in Agile community, and why we do the Agile trainings for women who are starting their management careers, is that not only do we tend to see a lack of diversity, a lack of gender diversity in the industry, but women exit at a higher rate than men do. And so the lack of gender diversity gets worse the higher up in the organization you go. And it's something of a self-fulfilling prophecy, because it is I think she points it out, the reason for it very nicely right here. It is a vicious circle in which you don't have women in executive positions, because they leave before they get to the executive position, and they leave before they get to the executive position because they don't see anybody above them who looks like them, and they don't believe they can do it. So when a vice president leaves to join another company, when a division head leaves to join another company, when the head of marketing leaves to join another company, that should be a fabulous opportunity not to look at that layer of men who are queued up for that position just below them, but to look outside the organization to start making some real meaningful changes mm-hmm. to the diversity of your top leadership teams.
Yes.
So, wow. Okay. This is going to be the longest podcast we've ever done, and we could go on and on and yes. on and on. There's so many things I wanted to say that I still haven't said.
I just bite my tongue constantly yes. to don't say anything more. Because, yeah.
So, but I think we've done a fair examination of the book.
Yes.
There's a lot of good ideas. there are some things that I'm not 100% on board about, and I've been clear about those, but there's a lot of really good ideas. There's a lot of things you can take away. There are things that can be done by anybody at any level of an organization, and it's cheap, short, and easy read. So I strongly recommend it to anybody who has an interest in diversity and inclusion in any knowledge management field.
Or who wants to just try an experiment with changing something in the culture with really low or no cost to see the outcome, yes.
So, I think, Justina, you already have a proposal for our next read. What have you got in mind?
Oh, yes. It's my dream to actually invite this person for the interview. So, I would suggest to read This Is Lean, Resolving the Efficiency Paradox, because I love being productive. I am the productivity freak. Paul taught me that if I get stressed in the line, I can just count the number of people that are in front of me and look how many are passing. And it actually saves my life. So I would like to read the book by Nicholas Modig and Per Alström, both Swedish authors, in our next podcast.
All right. I don't know the book at all, but I absolutely trust your...
No,
I don't.
Oh, my God. Really?
I haven't read it. I don't know the book.
Oh, my God. Yes, that's going to be fabulous, because actually I just watched three talks with Niklas, and he spent some time in Toyota doing some research, and he was sharing a lot of amazing experience that we can actually implement in the knowledge work. And the whole book is about the efficiency paradox, which I see, but I'm just sometimes lacking with the number of examples. So I think it will give us a lot of stories. And they're in the same time zone, so I think it might be easy to talk with them. And we are already friends on Twitter, so it's just one step closer to get to know them.
Fabulous. Okay, I really look forward to it. And so, listeners, that wraps up another episode of the Agile Book Club. This has been a little different, because we've been touching on some topics that are sensitive for a lot of people, threatening for some people, legitimately. And one of the things I said is that earlier in this podcast is that I guarantee you there's things that I've said in the last hour in this room with Justina that I will be ashamed of 10 years from now. Because when I think back to myself 5 years and 10 years ago, I can think of things that I am ashamed of now that I felt very strongly about at the time. And it's even possible that with your help, kind listeners, there may be some things that I'll be ashamed of 5 minutes after releasing the podcast. So it's essential to have healthy, respectful dialogues about these things. And now, I want to be clear about something here. When I say healthy and respectful, I don't necessarily mean gentle and kind. So if anything that Justina or I have said makes you angry, then by all means, feel free to express your anger. I wouldn't want to go trying to force civil discourse, because we didn't build this world by being civil. It was angry people who made the world that we live in today. And so angry people are welcome. But please, if there's something that I have said which is offensive or wrong, or just something that you want to discuss or explore with me, you'll find my email address in the show notes. Please bring it to my attention.
Yes, and same for me, actually. I would really appreciate any comments, because I'm still learning. And yes, I already feel a little bit bad about some things that I said. So I'm curious what our listeners might think. Yeah.
Thank you so much for listening, and stay tuned, because in 2 weeks, I'm hoping that we'll be able to interview the author.
Yeah. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.